Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam asher bachar banu mikol hamim v'natan lanu et torato. Baruch atah Adonai notein haTorah. Amen. Thank you. See, my mind just goes. Today is the yahrzeit of Hazel's father, and what was his name?
Raphael
Ben Shraga. It should be an aliyah for his neshama, and our learning today will be dedicated in his memory.
And it's the yahrzeit of my mother.
And the yahrzeit of your mother, and her name?
Sarah.
Sarah Bat Chaim, it should be an aliyah for her neshama as well. The good thing about learning in the merit of somebody is you can do it in the merit of more than one person, and you don't divide the pie. The pie just gets bigger. So it should be in the merit of aliyah for neshama for both your mother and your father.
And my father.
And your father's yahrzeit is also? Oh my gosh. And what's his name?
But I don't know the Hebrew name.
What was his name?
Herbert
Lapkoff. It should be an aliyah for his neshama. This must have been an auspicious time. Okay, it's right before Rosh Chodesh, so we're going to have Rosh Chodesh starts. He died on Rosh Chodesh. Favorite time, Rosh Chodesh, and it's Rosh Chodesh Adar, which means that we increase joy. So hopefully the people had brought joy to people's lives, and our learning will bring joy to us. So welcome to everyone here. Just another announcement is Roberta Feinsmith, who is sitting here in the red sweater here, a member of our class. I sent out an email to you, but just for those of you who want to see who she is teaching a beginner's Hebrew class on Tuesday mornings from 10:30 to 12 at her home in the Hilltop area, and she'll also be teaching a beginner's and intermediate class in Hebrew at the Alliance. So please talk to Roberta if you're interested or if you know somebody who's interested. So thank you. Always glad to have more people learn Hebrew. This week we are in Parsha Teruma, and we are beginning the parshas that are going to focus on the building of the Mishkan, the portable sanctuary. And they are parshas that are just fascinating in their detail, and because they're fascinating in their detail, many people find them boring in their detail because it's so detailed. And it's like reading an instruction manual, and that can be kind of hard. Even if you're building something amazing, if someone were to give you the specs with all of the details of how something was constructed, even if it was something amazing and beautiful, it would get tiresome because it's hard to feel the beauty in the directions. We usually tend to appreciate after it's built when we can see it. So blueprints, nobody says, oh, come look at the blueprints of my house. After it's built and furnished, they say, come look at my new house, and then you can appreciate it. So we tend to only appreciate the design details after the fact, but the truth is the whole thing would never have emerged without those details. So it doesn't just spontaneously materialize out of nothing. So the Torah is giving us insights into building of the Mishkan, and we're going to talk about that today. And we have to kind of keep in the back of our mind the question of all of the details, all of the parshas that are about the building of the Mishkan and all of its vessels and all of it, the clothing and the ark and the menorah and the altars and the curtains and the rods and the hooks. It really is like a Home Depot kind of catalog here. It's like, why do we even need to know this at all anyway? Because the Mishkan was a portable sanctuary that was in use for limited time, and it's like, so what difference does it make? Why do I have to know anything about it? It's just like it had its period of time, so what's in it for me, which is always our question that we want to ask. So let's just jump in, and we're going to start on page 445, which is where the parsha begins. And we're actually going to jump down to verse 8, because that's going to be the first verse that I would like to start with here. Page 445, verse 8, which is the bottom part of the text there. So, Roberta, would you like to read that for us, please?
They shall make a sanctuary for me, so that I may dwell among them, like everything that I show you. The form of the tabernacle and the form of all of its vessels and so shall you be.
Okay. This is the command. They shall make a sanctuary for me, and that the word for that in Hebrew is va'asuli mikdash. So a place, a mikdash, what is a mikdash? You probably recognize a word that's in there that sounds similar to Kodesh. So a place, a mikdash, is a place where holiness is found. It's also called the Beit HaMikdash, which is the holy temple. So even though this isn't the permanent structure, it's still called a mikdash. But the word mikdash, and you can learn when you take Hebrew with Roberta, that mikdash, if you have the letters there without the vowels, it's the same word as mikdash, which is the verb form to make holy. So a mikdash and mikdash are the exact same spelling. So that place of holiness is a place where we make things holy. So that, to keep that in mind, that it's not just a place where you build it and then you walk into it and so now you're holy. That the act of making something holy is what brings holiness. The action creates the reality. So that's just a slightly different concept, because sometimes we think that there should be a holy place, like if we could only get to a holy place, then we would be holy. But it doesn't work like that. It's the act of creating the holiness that you get what you create. And this was what God wanted the Jewish people to do. And this comes on the heels of receiving the Torah, which we talked about from Parsha Yitro and Mishpatim, all of the laws, all of that standing at Sinai. Now the next phase is going to be the building of this mikdash, of this place of holiness, or it's also called a mishkan. So the other word is a mishkan, and the word mishkan comes from the word shechina. Okay, from the word shechina or shochein, which means to dwell. Like in Hebrew, a neighborhood is called a shchuna, from the same place, a place where you dwell. So the shechina is where the concentrated essence of the divine presence shall rest in this place. So mishkan, mikdash, both are the same, but the shechina aspect has to do with what will be present as a result of going through this process of making ourselves holy, of being mikdash.
Helene. I always thought of the Shekhinah as being more of a feminine kind
of. People think of it as feminine, but we know that God is neither masculine nor feminine. But it's called feminine because anything that's talking about indwelling is in the mystical world is called feminine, and anything that's about outpouring is called masculine. From a male, like a male body, from the sexual side of things. Mm-hmm. Giving semen is called a masculine activity because it's about giving. Mm-hmm. Feminine is about the wombing, which is the receiving and defining and cultivating. That's called the feminine. Mm-hmm. So all of that, it has not necessarily to do with males and females, mm-hmm. as it does with, it's like if you go into, again, Home Depot, and you ask for a female whatever in the electrical system, they're not going to hand you a woman. They're looking for what's the relationship between the two parts. Are you talking about the part that grabs or the part that goes in? Yeah. So that's the same thing. It's structural and functional as opposed to anything judging or that kind of thing. So the Shekhinah is talking about the indwelling presence, that which is imminent, defined, and within a structure.
You know, it's so funny, Kim, when I lived in Israel, neighbors are called Shekhinim. And it's related to
It's the same thing.
I mean, it's like
it's where you dwell.
Yeah.
It's a divine place where you dwell.
It almost has a holy connotation.
It does. Thank God it should, hopefully. Yeah. So, I mean, in Hebrew, shchuna would also be the same thing if you were speaking Hebrew in, you know, Manhattan as well. But same thing, but it is. It's a holy place of dwelling. So this idea of the Shekhinah, this that there would be a place where there would be an intense place where we would experience God's presence, that's what the Mishkan was. And it specifically says, V'yasuli mikdash, you shall make for me a mikdash, v'shachanti betocham, and I will dwell in among them, the people. Not I will dwell in it, the building. It's the Shekhinah will dwell within the people. That's our goal, which also tells us we're not talking about building necessarily a holy building and then I walk in as just like a regular person and I'm just surrounded by holiness, but I haven't been transformed. We're talking about a place where we could go and experience a profound change in ourselves. So this command here is a command to the Jewish people at that time. But what it also says, the way verse 9 concludes, and it says, and so shall you do, the Hebrew is, v'chein ta'asu. and you shall do it also. Meaning, in every generation, because the Torah is for every generation, that all of us, we are all operating under the command of this particular command of what are we supposed to be doing? Vasuli mikdash. Make for me a mikdash, v'shachanti betocham, and I will dwell among you. So you could say, so where's the Mishkan? We don't have it. How do we build this Mishkan? So we do have the commandment that we are supposed to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, in Jerusalem, in the future. But in the meantime, does it mean like, well, we're off the hook until then? And the answer is, of course not. That we have a 24/7 opportunity to build ourselves into a mikdash. So a human being, a person, and a synagogue, places of worship, our Jewish homes, and ourselves, which are also all just smaller versions of the same thing, is called a mikdash me'at, a miniature sanctuary. So we are mikdash me'at, so we have an obligation to build ourselves into a mikdash me'at. Why? Because we want the Shekhinah, the divine presence, to come and dwell in our midst. So there's a really fascinating idea about the Shekhinah coming down.
Could you repeat again what the
V'chein ta'asu, and so shall you do.
Okay.
It's a command form and a future tense. So it's both forms in Hebrew grammar. It's ta'asu, you shall do it, command, and ta'asu, you will do it. And so it's understood of Rashi's commentary on that. And in the Gemara also says that it is for every generation at all time, commanded on all of us, which is why we need to know what the structure is, because if I'm supposed to do it, if Ellen Hutt's supposed to do it, then I need to know what that is so that I can do it. And this gives me the pattern to follow of how to create holiness in a way that's in this world and not a standing on Har Sinai. So this is really an interesting concept, is once the Jewish people have stood at Mount Sinai, that experience was called the wedding. That's called the wedding between us and God. We receive the Ten Commandments. That's considered like the ketubah. And we're the bride. God's the groom. It says even the Mount Sinai is described in one place as the chuppah, that it was like held over the Jewish people. There's some midrashim that says it was held over us as kind of a threat, but it was also held over us as a promise of we're in this relationship together. But as we know in our regular lives, that the wedding is amazing, but what's the most important part of the whole relationship? It's not the wedding. It's afterwards, when you go home, after you go home and you have your life together. So this is the parallel, is that we stood at Mount Sinai, that was our wedding, and it was like God as the groom is happy to have us as the bride, the Jewish people. But if it's not followed by now we're going to go home and live together and have a relationship that's going to be in this world, nuts and bolts, then you didn't really have anything. In fact, a lot of people have found that maybe they should have spent more time thinking about their marriage than about their wedding, because people get a little bit sidetracked on what is the more important thing. So it is the life together afterwards, the marriage, that is really the significant place. So that is the Mishkan represents, we're coming home together. So one idea that people always struggle with is, says, if God's presence is everywhere, then why do we have a place? That seems like so confining. It says that God's saying, well, that's true. I'm infinite. I fill the entire cosmos. But infinitely big also means when one is infinite, it also means infinitely small. God's saying, you think the Mishkan is too small for me? Wait till you see why I'll compress my essence between the wings of the Kruvim, of the cherubs above the ark. I will condense it there. Not that I'm not other places, but there's a more concentrated feeling. Same thing, again, going to a relationship. When my husband and I part in the morning when he goes to work, it's not that I'm no longer married because he's in a different place, but in our home and in our relationship, and what's called in a home the Holy of Holies is the bedroom. The parents' bedroom is called the Holy of Holies because that's where the relationship is experienced in its most intense form. Doesn't mean that we're not married in the kitchen. Doesn't mean that we're not married when we go out. It just means that the relationship has the possibility to be experienced in a more intense form in the more private, intimate space, and that's what God is telling the Jewish people. You will experience our relationship in a more intense way in this place. Many people have gone to Israel when they are in Yerushalayim. They feel that sometimes when they just land in Israel, you know, especially if you've like traveled El Al and when they make the announcements and before they built the new airport and you actually landed and walked out on the ground, some people just would feel it then. Going to Yerushalayim, going to Jerusalem, going to the Kotel, that people would feel intensifying significance and experience and presence of being in a holy place. So it doesn't mean, it doesn't rule out the other, it just says that there are places where we can experience more because of what's going on there. So that it is God's desire, as we can say. So we're going to anthropomorphize God a lot here, and it's not because we think God takes any physical form, but that's the language we have. It's God's desire to dwell in this world with us. In other words, it's called really making heaven on earth. God says, as it were, you know, I could be in the lofty heavens with the angels and the seraphim and all the things that we refer to in the Kedusha when we talk about the heavenly creatures who praise God. God's like, I've got them. I've got them. I want to come down. I want to be right here in this world. That's what gives me the greatest nachas. It's easy to be with the lofty, holy creatures up there because they don't have the same challenges or opportunities that we do, that what God created for us. I want to be here. So there's a beautiful reference in Song of Songs. So we want to turn to that now for just a moment to see what we're talking about. So you can put your string here for now and then turn to page 1266 and we will take a look at Shir HaShirim. Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs, is understood. It's the greatest love poem, love story written. And it is read on Pesach. It's read on Pesach. It's also, some people have the custom to read it on Shabbos afternoon, which is our time of the intimate, most intimate time of Shabbos. It gets more and more intimate as Shabbos day goes by. And Shabbos afternoon is considered like very intense. And some people at Mincha have an opportunity time where they will recite Shir HaShirim. So we're going to look at Shir HaShirim, and we're going to look at chapter 5, verse 1. Shir HaShirim, hold on one second, I think I should turn to it. Ah, okay. Let's read that. This is a dialogue between God and the Jewish people that is being read. Rachel, would you like to read starting chapter 5, verse 1?
To your tabernacle dedication, my sister, O bride, I came as of my garden.
As if to.
As if to my garden. Mm-hmm. I gathered my myrrh with my spice from your princely incense. I accepted your unbidden as well as your bidden offerings to me. I drank your libations pure as milk. Eat, my beloved priests. Drink and become God intoxicated, O friends.
Don't you just love that word, God intoxicated? It's like, wow, that's intense. Okay, to your tabernacle dedication, my sister, O bride, I came as if to my garden. So it says, what is this referring to? So the tabernacle dedication, as we're talking about the dedication of the Mishkan, which is going to be later in a number of parshas, in the parsha of Naso, they're going to talk about the dedication of the Mishkan. And it's referred to as, it says here, hold on one second. Right. So this is the allegorical interpretation of it. But let's take a look at where it says here, Bati legani achoti kala. It says, I have come to my garden, my sister, the bride. I mean, who's the sister, who's the bride? It's talking about the Jewish people. This whole thing, Art Scroll gives the allegorical interpretation of this. Some people object to that, some people appreciate it, but it is what it is. This is what we understand it. Bati legani, to my garden. What is my garden a hint to? What does it sound like? Any other references in Torah to garden? The Garden of Eden says, ah, I'm coming, bati legani achoti, I've come now to my garden, and my garden being the Garden of Eden. So we have an understanding, and the Gemara is full of references to this, as are the Midrashim, that talk about that when God created creation, that Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve, had a direct experience of God's presence. We have them talking to God. We have God talking to them. God's presence was imminent, completely present. So God's presence was completely there in the garden, and it was obvious. Well, clearly something happened. So we all know what happened. What happened to Adam and Eve? We had a sin. We had the sin of the garden of eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So we have, it's all actually laid out very dramatically. I actually made a little box. This came from Rabbi Abba Wagensberg, as well as from the Nativo Shalom, the Paths of Peace. It talks about that when Adam sinned, that God's presence left in a the concentration lessened. Not God was gone, but God's concentration and imminent presence lessened. I'm sure all of us have places that we don't really want to go. Physical places, like parts of town, certain kinds of establishments, where we're like, you know what, if that's going on there, I don't really want to be there, because it's kind of, it's not for me. It's not for me. So God's saying, it's like, if you're having this level of sin, then my presence can't be here in the same concentration. And so it says that God's presence ascended, the Shekhinah ascended, withdrew to the first heaven. And then when Cain killed Abel, it's like, oh, now we got murder on top of it. Okay, I really want to be someplace where there's sinning and murder. That sounds good. So it says that God's presence withdrew to the second heaven. And then there was the sin of Enosh, who introduced idolatry to the world, first with good intentions, but things went very badly. It says that God's presence went to the third heavens. Then there was the generation of the flood, and it went to the fourth heavens. Then there was the building of the Tower of Babel, when the people decided they wanted to go to war against God, whatever, how they understood that, to have human power and technology over God's power, like, we're the masters of the universe, not you. So it says that then God's presence retreated to the fifth heaven, and then with the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah, that it ascended to the sixth heaven, and then the Egyptians in the time of Abraham, not the Egyptians at the time of the Jewish people later, but even at the time of Abraham and their immorality, that God's presence, the Shekhinah, ascended to the seventh heaven. So when you hear that reference in the vernacular, seventh heavens, that's Jewish origin. And the Gemara talks about that there are seven heavens. They're called rakias, seven heavens, and that God's presence ascended up to that level, meaning, now we associate, I'm in seventh heaven, meaning that's a good thing. But when you're talking about God's presence withdrawing, that's a bad thing. It means that it was less felt. And you could say the less felt it was, in a way, the worse things got, because then there wasn't an imminent experience of God's presence. Ah, but then to save the day, it says we had then seven people who brought down the Shekhinah, brought down the divine presence back down to earth. Because God's goal is, I don't want to be in the seventh heaven. I want to have heaven on earth. That's my goal. What brought it back down? So it says the first person who brought it down to the first, brought it from the seventh to the sixth, was Abraham. And because he then is the one who recognized God and starts teaching the world again about God, not for the first time. This is a reintroduction. God reintroduces God to humanity and calls out in God's name. It says that God's, that the Shekhinah then came back from the seventh to the sixth. Yitzchak brought it from the sixth to the fifth. Yaakov from the fifth to the fourth. Levi from the fourth to the third. Kahat was one of the sons of Levi, who was in charge of carrying the most holy vessels of the Mishkan, the Ark, the menorah. Not that the curtains weren't holy, but there was a hierarchy in what was there. The holiest of holy things was Kahat. Amram, who was Moshe's father, then takes it from the second to the first level of the rakias, of the heavens. And then Moshe is the one who brings God then finally back down to earth through the building of the Mishkan. So in the building of the Mishkan, we have, if we go now back, we're going to go to Parsha Bamidbar.
Can I ask you a question real quick?
Sure.
With the golden calf,
where did that work?
Where did that come in? Where does God go?
Where does God go? It's like, okay, now we're starting this again. Good question. I didn't see that, but that's a great question. So we kind of have this, you could say, we have this up and down relationship. And the truth is it is not a static relationship. And that we have levels where we deal with it at the personal level, at the community level, and at the world level. So, and that each person, so it's like when an individual, even though we don't believe in being personally saved, we do believe that a person as an individual can create a life that brings more of the divine presence more down into them. Mm-hmm. And that hopefully not for their own personal benefit, but to then enlighten and bring light to others as well, so that it can be felt. But it's a responsive relationship. It is, you know, you you build it, and I will dwell in you. It's not, I will dwell in you so that you can build it. It's like, who acts first? We do. We're the initiators of the relationship. It says, I will give you the relationship you want. You want it, you got it. But you have to want it. If you don't want it, I can't be here for it, because this is a responsive, interactive relationship. You can only have, your relationship is only as good, I read this in a relationship book, it's only as good as the person who wants it the least. It's not the one who wants it the most. It's, you have to want it, otherwise you can't have it, which we know, unfortunately. If only we could make someone else want it. If only God could make us want it, we can't. Okay, so that's a limitation. If we turn in the book of Bamidbar, the book of Numbers, and we're going to turn to chapter 7, verse 1. Hold on, we'll get the page here. Chapter 7, verse 1 is on page 765. This is just the reference to the finishing of the erecting of the tabernacle, so we're just going to see this in the print here. Kay, would you like to read that for us? No, okay. Would you, Cece, would you like to read that for us? Page 765, chapter 7, verse 1.
It was on the day that Moses finished erecting the tabernacle that he anointed it, sanctified it and all its utensils, and the altar and all its utensils. And he had anointed and sanctified them.
Okay, so this was the sanctification, and the Hebrew word of that, of course, is Oto Va Yikadesh, and God and Moshe sanctified it. So it wasn't just we put up the building and now we had a grand opening. There was a process of sanctification. It says, and then when that happened, that was like the day that the marriage begins. That's the day we go home. That's the day where everything happens. But who built the Mikdash? I mean, since God created the entire world, if God wanted a Mikdash to a Mishkan to suddenly materialize, it could have been an amazing, I mean, it kind of actually pales in comparison to the 10 plagues and the splitting of the sea and the giving of Torah on a scale of he made a building come into being. It would be like, that's not even such a big trick. But who built the building? We did. So it was like all the efforts of all the people who wanted to be part of the relationship, that's who got to be in the relationship. And luckily, everybody wanted to have a part of it. We know that had there been a group that didn't want to be a part of it, guess what we would have heard about in the Torah? There was a group that didn't want to be a part of it and caused a problem. Nobody caused a problem. Everyone wanted to be a part of it, and everybody had a role. They had so many donations as fundraisers. This is like the dream come true. Moshe had to say, stop, stop.
No more.
No more. That was the miracle, never mind the building of the Mishkan, that everybody just was so wanted it. Interestingly, the building of the Mishkan is the only mitzvah where we are told that it needs to be lishma. It has to be because you want it for God's sake. It has to be what's called lishma, for the sake of heaven. Because otherwise, you just have a building. How do you know that you have something special unless you know why you did it? So other things, you can put on tefillin, if you're a man, you can put on tefillin. And not that it doesn't matter if you aren't paying attention to it or you're not doing it for heaven's sake, but you have fulfilled the mitzvah. You can give tzedakah, and it doesn't really matter if your intention is, I want to give tzedakah. It's paying a bill. You owe 10% of your income to other people, organizations, etc. It's a bill. It's like when you write your check, if you owe money to the IRS, they don't really care if you wanted to give it or not. They don't care. It's like, as long as we get the check, we don't really care. If you feel like very patriotic about it, great. If you don't, fine. So it doesn't matter as much for other mitzvahs. It is, yes, a component part, and it elevates the mitzvah, but it's not the essence of the mitzvah. Building of the Mishkan, now let's go back to our parsha again, and we will see, we want to go back now to page 445, back to Truma, and now we are going to read the verses 1 and 2, and this will put this in a context for us. Hetty, would you like to read for us page 445? Yeah, we're going back, jumping back to Truma. Verses 445, verses 1 and 2.
Hashem spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, and let them take for me a portion. For every man whose heart motivates him, you shall take my portion.
Okay. These are going to be portions and donations to build the Mishkan. Who is supposed to give?
Everyone.
Everyone who?
Who wants to.
If you don't want to, don't do it. I don't want it if it's not coming from a place of wanting. There are other mitzvahs where, like the half shekel, where everyone had to give it. So there are some things that are commanded. This is, I only want it if you want to be, if you want to give. Lynn.
When we read about the bride and to extend the marriage analogy, and this is perfect because it says man, so the obligation is for every person to want it, or every man, is it different?
Every person. Every
just
person.
By chance, that says
yes, because in fact we know, and the Midrashim tell us, there's a great, where is, I won't look for it now, but it specifically says in giving the donations for the Mishkan, it says, and the man came upon the women. What does that mean? It says the women gave first. So it's one of our merits of Rosh Chodesh. We did not give one thing to the building of the golden calf, and we were first to give on the Mishkan, and the men followed us. It's like the women took the spiritual lead in being motivated. So it specifically says that the men came on the heels of the women who were donating. So it's for everyone to want. Yes.
Kol Ish means like everybody.
I mean, Kol Ish, it depends. Sometimes it means only men, but this means everyone. Everyone, and it says the men and the women and the people did all the jobs. This was a group effort. In fact, and even young and old. But Salel, who was put in charge of the whole project, he was 13 years old. No. So he was, you know, everyone's like, oh, isn't that interesting? Just happens to be the nephew of Moshe. That looks like nepotism. So, but he was called by God to do it, because Bezalel means in the shadow of God, that he had the wisdom and
understanding. Great artist.
Yeah, Bezalel, that's the name of the art play at school in Israel. It's Bezalel. So he's 13 years old and he had that. So this was everybody. Everyone has this obligation. And it's because also we're talking about each person. The Jewish people cannot exist with only half the population involved in holiness and the other half sitting it out. So this is, everyone is supposed to make this mikdash me'at, to make this holy place inside us. So when Moshe erects and puts up the Mishkan, and then it's ready for business, and it's ready then for the people to be in it, but they really have created already the holiness part of it by actually building it, being involved in all of the nitty-gritty. So being holy is not just a lofty, generic idea. It is a detailed process and path that one goes through. You can't just beam yourself up to a place of holiness. If we could do it, that would be great. We did do it at Mount Sinai. It says at Mount Sinai, when we received the Torah, that was a beaming up. In fact, the whole Exodus from Egypt is described, and it's only time there where God uses language that is allegorical. Because God says, I lifted you and I carried you on Kanfei Nisharim. I lifted you on eagle's wings. On eagle's wings means you were off the ground. That's the definition. I took you up in the air. I took you off of the regular level. I took you to a height, but I took you there. You didn't get there yourself. So now that you've seen it, now that you're up there, we had the wedding, and you've had this experience, now let's go back down to earth, and now let's build that same relationship, but now it needs to be in an earthly plane, and it needs to be with physical material items. So there were 13 different items, 13 different materials that were used for the Mishkan. Beautiful colors, you know, the turquoise and purples and reds and gold and silver and beautiful woods. I mean, it was gorgeous, totally gorgeous. It says, so that's interesting. It needs to be gorgeous because we want the best of what the physical world has to offer. And Judaism is not a don't be involved with the physical world. We don't walk around with, you know, whatever, goat hair shirts or whatever. It's like, dress pretty. Shabbos is when we enter the Mishkan again. Where are your beautiful clothes? Where is the best that the physical world has to offer? That's what I want you to use in your life, is your physicality, the physicality of the physical world, and bring it up, and that's what I want. That's making my presence felt on earth. Don't step away from it. Moshe, it says, was interesting. It says, Moshe could have stayed on Mount Sinai forever. He was like one of those people who could exist, like without the eating and drinking, 40 and 40 days, that was for him. But God was like, that may be for you, but that's not for the Jewish people. I want my presence to be on the earth. So you need to go back down and be with the rest of the people. So that some people are, they're like the lofty spiritual souls, but that's not Judaism. Judaism is for what is for all of us, like the regular, ordinary people, which is who we are. It says, use your physicality, use everything. So, Bethan, did you have a question?
Yeah, just a little bit. I think you sort of answered it, though. I was concerned because still stuck on those levels.
Of those.
Yeah, because when people sin, when things are not good, that's when we need Hashem even more. And it sounds like that's when he's...
Okay, so this isn't saying that, like, when we're in trouble and when we need God. We're saying that when we make errors that are critical errors that push away the relationship, just as you can do that in a relationship. You can do something that's a betrayal of trust, and it would be pretty chutzpahdik to say, well, why aren't you feeling close to me now?
Right.
You'd say, because what you did pushes me away. How can I be close? You do something to bring me close, I can be close. So that each of those people did something, either their generation, those people, did something to be able to bring God's presence close so that it could be, like how we went in our sukkah, when we say the divine presence is in our sukkah, that is also considered like a little mikdash me'at, that's a little holy place, and that the divine presence is experienced in a more intense way there. So as we go through the description of everything in the Beit HaMikdash, or in the Mishkan, it is interesting to see. Oh, let's see. I'm going to give you one other reference. Yes.
Can I just ask you a quick question?
Sure.
So do you think this means that, like, when you do something wrong, that you have seven levels of wrongness that God's going to back away from you?
Not necessarily all seven, but there is a backing away. There is a distance.
Like,
there is a distancing.
Each time you do something.
That's why we have the process called teshuvah. That's why we have return and repentance, is because we believe it's a dynamic relationship. It's not like, wow. In fact, we're told, don't ever think that you have pushed God so far. And the truth is, I have to say, it's really a little backwards. We're the ones who have backed away. God stays the same. Okay? If you take yourself away, that's why teshuva is returning to the relationship. So it's the one who did the sin, who made the mistake, who made the error in judgment, who has really pushed themselves away. And then it's a little chutzpahdik again to say, how come you're so distant from me? It's like, well, look, let's talk about who distanced who here, or whom, or whatever the correct grammar is. We've distanced ourselves. So, but we call it God retreating because that's how we experience it. I read something that was like interesting that says, we still say the sun set or the sun rose, even though we know the sun is not rising or setting. The earth is moving. The sun is staying the same. But from our experience, it looks like the sun is rising, the sun is setting. So from our experience, we are experiencing it as a retreat, and that's what it's considered to be. So then who is the one who can come back? It's not like, well, God, come back. It's like, you come back. So it says, Shuvie, like, you know, come back to me and I will return to you because I'm waiting. You're the one who has created the distance. So on every day, at the end of the day, one of the things that we do before we go to sleep is we're supposed to do teshuvah and ask forgiveness and make amends for the things that we've done that have created that distance. Right, the Shema, the bedtime.
Every day,
because you're supposed to repent the day before you die, and since we don't know when that's going to be, we take our precautions every night. I don't know, I'm going to wake up in the morning. So every day I do that. Plus, who can really go till Yom Kippur and remember everything that they did every single day? I mean, I have a general sense, but it's like, you know, when someone asks in a performance appraisal to write down your accomplishments for the year, unless you were keeping track of it in some way and doing a cheshbon, an accounting, you'd be hard-pressed to kind of come up with that. So it's better to take care of these things quickly and for our own benefit because we want to be close. That's the pleasure is the closeness. That's what we want. Susan?
So in that case, we're repenting to God, not to another.
Right, we're good. So the thing is that it can be both. When we do something to another person, we have to fix that. But when we do something to another person, we have also sinned against God because that person is God's child. And I don't know about you, but I know how I feel about people who've done any wrong to my child. They've harmed me. So
We should make our amends to other people before we go to
sleep. Yeah, it would be a good idea if we have the courage to do it. The goal is, what was that?
Don't get angry.
Yeah, it behooves us to do as best we can. But certainly, the sins between us and God, we should for sure take care of, because we don't even have to call, text, email, or anything. It's just right there. So we're supposed to, and that's part of keeping ourselves in a state of purity. So purity doesn't mean some esoteric state of being. It means a constant state of keeping, you know, keeping the laundry clean and keeping up. It's like, why wait for things to accumulate if you can take care of it? I mean, we know that schmutz cleaned off early and quickly does not set, we don't want set in stains. Not that God can't take care of those later anyway. God can and we can. But why wait if you can take care of it sooner rather than later? So, yes.
And the Shema Lamita, the Shema in the bed, it's very beautiful because you also forgive others.
Ah, exactly. We forgive other people too, because part of the thing that we hang on to is we forgive other people. And what's beautiful in there, it says whether they offended us, whether we have an issue with them in this lifetime or from a previous incarnation. Maybe we're carrying an issue with someone and we don't really even, not even sure why. Could have been a previous issue that needs to be taken care of now that we were sent into this world to take care of it here. So, yes, Linda.
Is there a good source that you could recommend that explains a little bit more of these seven heavens? I've had a hard time wrapping my head around that.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, the seventh heaven, it's throughout the Gemara. This came from a shiur from a class from Rabbi Abba Wagensberg that was on the aishaudio.com. But I think... I think it's a subscription. You have to pay for it, but you can download it if you want. It's fascinating. Abba, like Father, Wagensberg. Abba Wagensberg. And so, yeah, it's really interesting. And there are references to it of all throughout the Gemara about the seventh heavens, but that God doesn't want to be far away. God wants... See, when we talk about far away, we tend to think in distance, and I'm moving my hand like this, but we're talking about... spiritual closeness versus, it's like when I say I feel really far away from someone, I'm not saying I live 15 miles away from them. I'm saying that there's something in the relationship, there's a spiritual distance, and those are called the heavens. So that's what we're talking about, more than like I can see to the seventh heaven. It's like we're not talking about in the physicality, in the realm of physicality. Okay. All right. So this is I thought was so fascinating. This is from a short video that was from Rabbi David Foreman. And he only began it, and he's going to do more of it next week. It was a 10-minute thing. And he said, it's so interesting, because we talk about the Mishkan then being a parallel for us and our bodies and our homes of what it is we're trying to achieve and accomplish in holiness. What does it mean? It says, we can look at the Mishkan, and his question is there a face in the Mishkan? It's like, is there a face in the building of the Mishkan itself? It's like, okay, what are you talking about? So basically, and I just sketched this out, said the way the Mishkan was laid out with all of its parts is very carefully indicated. It has to be set up a very specific way. Instead of up and down, though, just think of like flat, okay? But the same thing, a top, middle, and bottom. So it says, in the centermost area was the ark, which had the Torah in it, as well as the tablets, the broken tablets, as well as the second set of tablets that the Jewish people got on Yom Kippur, for Yom Kippur. So at the very top is the Torah. Right outside of that, and that's in the Holy of Holies, right outside of that, on one side is the menorah, and on the other side was the shulchan, which was the bread that had the 12 loaves of bread. Kind of in between that and down was the incense altar. And then right below that, at the very bottom or outside, was the altar where the animals were sacrificed. What does that look like to you? It's a face. Okay, so it says this is the mind where the Torah is, must be encountered intellectually. One must study. One has to learn. You can't just, you know, be off and not doing anything. There's no, just like anything else, you have to learn. A child needs to learn anything. We don't just say to a child, well, you know, I gave birth to you, so like now you're on your own. And it's like as soon as we start, they even have educational toys for while the baby is in utero. You play them certain music and you hold a, I don't know, flashlight up to your stomach. I don't know. You do something to make them intelligent. So we understand that education is not an option. It's a given for a human being. And it's a given for a Jewish human being to be educated and to learn Torah. So it says the mind is the holy of holies. And then come the eyes. And the eyes, the menorah, which we knew, was a symbol of light, okay? Of light, of to be enlightened, to see and have perspective, how we look at things. That was the menorah. And then choosing what we look at. It says what the bread that was out, it was called lechem panim. It was called show bread. It was looked at for a week. It was kept out for a week, and then the Kohanim would eat it at the end of the week and put new breads out for the next week. So it's like, what are you supposed to do with it? It's like to show, what was it supposed to show? That God is a source of providence in the world, and that we have an opportunity to look at our world and our own particular lives, say, how do you look at the world? Do you see, oh, everything is just a coincidence, it's, you know, it's just luck, it's just this, it's just that. You can choose that way, or you can choose the lechem panim model. You can choose the showbread, which shows that God is the source of providence, that God is the one who is controlling the world. So this has to do with the true meaning of sight, which is to have spiritual enlightenment and perspective and how we look out and how we see the world. The incense, which is clearly the nose, the incense was about creating a good smell and was the antidote to Lashon Hara, was the antidote to gossip. And it was supposed to create, it says, why, it says like that, gossip creates like a bad smell for the Jewish people, and that the incense is to have a way of speak, even though it's not about the mouth, it's about how we relate to the world and the aura that we create through our speech had to do with the incense. So that the incense was, again, the antidote and to come to repair and fix how we speak in the world, because how we speak creates an aura. And then we have the altar, the place where the animals were sacrificed, you could say where they were consumed, which has to do with our mouth. And we say that our tables, now, when we have a meal, why do we say blessings? Why do we wash before we make hamotzi? It says because our table is an altar, and the way I eat my food, it can either be done in an animalistic way, like I'm hungry, I'm just going to scarf something down, or it can be I'm doing it in holiness, and the animal instinct in me is being devoted to God. It's not just like, well, I'm hungry, so I'm eating. It's something I'm eating so that I can gain energy, so that I can fulfill my potential in the world and fulfill my obligations today that I have that lead toward that potential. So it says, this is showing us our face. This says like our face is the key, that if we would look at our face with the model of the Mishkan, we would understand this is the path to achieve holiness. It's not something that we can be beamed up to. It's not a place that we can walk into and it'll just kind of stick to us. It is an effort. It's called an avoda. It is an effort that we put into getting there. So this was from Rabbi David Foreman. He's going to expand on it next week. I'm like, I hate miniseries. I hated it on TV when I used to watch them. Like, just show me the whole show already. I'll sit here for 13 hours and watch every episode. I just can't stand when they say, and next week we'll continue. So next week he'll continue with more of that, but this is what was to be gleaned for this time, and just understanding, because the details of it, it's like, who cares? You know, what if you hire a designer and say, you know what, I think the menorah would look nicer over there. And that bread, maybe over there, is like, you want your face like that? It's like, no, this is like a set up a certain way, because it's all conveying a message to us of what we're supposed to do so that we can fulfill our opportunity that God is giving us, that we should build a place of holiness so that God can dwell in us. This same idea is also expressed in another way. And we understand, we have to understand that this is... every word of Torah can be understood with 70 different facets. It's like a diamond. You say, well, which part's the real diamond? It's like the fact that it has the different facets is what makes it sparkle. If you only had a flat surface, you would have no sparkle. It says the Torah is the same way. Every word, every idea can be looked at in 70 different ways that help illuminate a different aspect for us to appreciate. So there is another idea of looking at the same concept of these three levels of the Holy of Holies, then what was considered the holy area. In fact, let's take a look at it, because I give like a, it's not really such a great picture, but it gives a little bit of a picture. In this week's Parsha, they show it, and it looks, doesn't look so interesting. I'll tell, just warn you up front. If you look on page 463, page 463 is the sketch, and it has the outer area. It has, first of all, the whole Mishkan itself, but it has the outer courtyard. Then it has what's called the tabernacle, but it doesn't show then the Holy of Holies in here. But there's really basically three sections. The outer area, which is called the ordinary area, the holy area, which is more elevated, and then the Holy of Holies, which is the highest area. That was where the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, only went in once a year on Yom Kippur. But basically the same idea of three. So it says that the person's body is the same way, that we have what's called our Holy of Holies, then we have our holy area, and then we have kind of like the ordinary part of us. So it says that the Holy of Holies, this comes from Rabbi Abba Wagensberg, but he's quoting other sources as well. The Holy of Holies, still in this model, is the mind of a person, which corresponds to the Torah. And it has to do with, so what are we supposed to do? What does that mean? It means that we are supposed to, our service of our mind is the service of our thoughts, of our perspective, of the way we think, of our philosophy. And that the Torah is the source for us for developing that philosophy in our way of thinking. We think, when someone says, I'm a free thinker, that's really the last thing they are. What it is whatever the last books they chose to read about, that's what they think. And that's what they call being a free thinker. So a free thinker, there's no such thing. We are influenced by what we read and what we study. That becomes the way we think and what people around us are talking about. So that way of thinking is called hashkafa. And the word is interesting because it has to do with hashkafa means kind of philosophy, but the word for glasses in Hebrew is mishkafayim, the way you see things, okay? Your perspective is determined by what you let in. So the Torah is supposed to be the source of our mishkafayim through the lens of Torah that we are supposed to devote our mind. The next holy area is our heart. That has to do with our wants, our will, and it's also connected to wealth. So the things that we do is like what we want, okay? Like, oh, I want that. And like, oh, my will, I want to do this, I want to do that. So it's not just like I want. It's like when I say I want to go somewhere, that's also an expression that's called an expression of the heart. It says that is also supposed to be something, an avoda. What's the avoda of my heart? The service of my heart is to align my heart with wanting and having my will be aligned with God's will. It's like, I want to want what God wants for me. Part of our understanding of prayer, of tefillah, is that that's the process we're going through. It's not just, God, I want this, I want that. It's like, God, I want to want what you want for me. So let's think about what that is. And I think I want this, but I'm not sure that's the best. And we say at the end of our prayer, of our davening, that God should fulfill our desires for our good. Because you ever heard the phrase, be careful what you wish for? We don't always know. We think we know what we want. And then you get it, it's like, I'm not sure that's really what I wanted. So it says, like, this is what I think I want. I want to be aligned with your will. So give me whatever it is that will help me fulfill that. And that's called the avoda of our heart.
Is this just part of the Holy of Holies?
No, this is the next area. This is the next level. So Holy of Holies was about perspective and our mind and our philosophy. The next is about our will, of what we want. And then it says the outside altar, which was where the animals were sacrificed, has to do with our animalistic parts of ourselves, which has to do our other organs, which has to do with our passions and our drives. The things that we think we have no control over because it's just the animalistic part of us. It's like, yes you do, yes we do, and that's the service of the outer courtyard. It's called our other limbs, the part of us that, you know, when people, you know, can get themselves in trouble or whatever, that's the part of us we're really talking about. What are our drives and our passions? Even though we associate passion with heart, we're really talking about the call of hormones, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, taivas, of desires that can take us in the wrong direction. It's like we want to have those also be under the auspices and be used in a holy way. Again, Judaism is not about denying physical drives or physical desires. We have a whole body of law that tells us how to use sexuality, how to use our desires even for our desires for honor, our desires for all the things that can go off in the totally wrong direction can all be channeled in the right direction. So that's taking this entire Mishkan, the entire Ohel Moed, the entire tabernacle, saying that this is a model for the three levels of a person completely, not just of the face, but then taking of the head, the mind, the heart, and the limbs and organs that we have. It says, and that this gives God the greatest pleasure, that when all of this can be brought into service, that then we can really fulfill the opportunity is that you should build this, as the Parsha first started out, when it says, they shall make a sanctuary for me, the Asuli Mikdash. They shall make it a place of holiness for me, v'shachanti b'tocham, and then I can dwell in them. And then it will be a place where God's presence can be on earth. Because our goal truly is to make heaven on earth and to bring God's presence into such stark focus and reality that it becomes obvious that there is holiness in this world and what the gift is that God is trying to give us. So God willing, as we go through these parshas, these next few parshas, and have an opportunity to talk about some of the other details, that we'll see how each of them has just myriad layers and levels of understanding and insight for us on how to live our lives. So God willing, we can do that, and we will meet next week. So have a good Shabbos.
Yes, if you go to Israel, very near enough, the Germans actually built the Mishkan model with all the blocks of the tribes, exactly, they say, I didn't measure. Like it says here. Like
I remember you brought me pictures of that.
Right.
Yeah. I have them probably someplace at home.
Near
Eilat. One other reminder, a housekeeping thing. I just want to make another plug for the Jewish Experience Wine, Cheese, and Chocolate event. My husband and I are co-chairs of.
Wow.
We're looking forward to a really fun evening a week from this Saturday night, February 8th. And it's going to be at the Event Center in Glendale. And it's called Infinity Park. And we would love to have you. It should be a really fun evening. You can call me. You can call me if you want to call the Jewish Experience. You can talk to Lynn Cooper right here. Has registration forms. We'd love to have you. It's a great organization, and it should be a really fun evening. And if you can't come, we have raffle tickets for great prizes.
And we should all do it, since Alan is cheering.
Exactly. That's right. Thank you. And Hetty is coming.
Right. I'll come too. I forgot to tell you that if you go to this place, the tour guide said, come in the Holy of Holies, right? And I tried to go a little...